to The Cooler Ring, a podcast for manufacturing marketers brought to you by Cooler Partners. My name is Jeff White, and joining me today, and only joining me today, is Carmen Perry. Carmen, how are you doing, sir? You're on mute.
I'm excited for today's guest. A delight, in fact.
Yes, no, he is. He's amazing. He's amazing.
No, it is. Look, it's happy to be here. It's good to be joining you for one of the rare occasions when we don't bring somebody else onto the show, frankly, yeah. And just kind of kick around what's going on these days in one area or another of the wonderful world of manufacturing marketing.
Yeah, and not often that we get to explore the more, maybe a bit more of the technical side of manufacturing marketing. You know,
that's true.
Plays into some of the things I'm interested in, for sure.
Yeah, and folks, to bring you into the loop, what we're thinking is that, you know, there's a lot of changes happening right now, not just driven by AI, certainly partially or at least in somewhat in large part driven by AI, but not exclusively. And these changes impact. Frankly, just if you're building a website in 2025, 2026, you need to be thinking about it differently. And there's just been some changes in the last year or two, or evolutions, one might say. It's not just like not complete like 180 degree shifts, but more just things that kind of were somewhat important before and now are very important. And I think it would be good for listeners to understand some of those dynamics and just kind of be thinking about them. Should they be heading into a website redesign initiative or thinking about how they evolve their digital platform more broadly?
Yeah. And I mean, to say that the game has changed is almost to undersell it a little bit. You know, even if you were talking about 3 years ago, there's no question that most of your traffic came probably in some way or another from Google. You know, you probably weren't really thinking about how you might show up in AI generated results. Probably were still deploying a content strategy that was largely search optimization focused, you know, and you were also probably able to track people in ways that maybe you can't now and won't be able to in the future. So anyway,
and that tracking part is an important one because, of course, it, you know, so much of the kind of the go-to-market motion, to use industry lingo, is fueled by that. I mean, let's dive into it. And again, I do want to stress it's not exclusively AI and its impact. And I think, you know, the way I'd like to kick it off, Jeff, if we could, is not AI driven really at all, because I think one of the things that seems to have changed is the importance of speed. And to me, like, speed online has always been a lot like leads. Like, you know, if you ask somebody how many leads do they want, well, the answer is more, and a lot more, and there's no way that that's a bad thing. Unless they're just unqualified, I suppose. Yeah. And similar with speed, like it was like, oh well, yeah, speed's good, but it was like, and of course, I think people treated it as though it's a nice to have. Sure, it would be nice if the web was faster. Sure, it would be nice if our site was faster. And sure, maybe it is kind of impacting our rank a bit.
But boy, do we like these WordPress plugins.
Yeah, yeah. Or they're certainly willing to make a lot of other trade-offs, it seems, both in terms of not optimizing content for speed, site structure for speed, WordPress plugins for speed. My goodness, one of the biggest things we've ever seen. But so I guess what are you seeing there? That like how has the conversation around speed evolved?
Well, I think it's changing quite a lot, and I think if you put yourself. You know, if you're thinking of your web property, if you're a marketer and a manufacturer, and you're thinking of what, you know, you're weighing those trade-offs between the functionality of another WordPress plugin or another jQuery add-in to track things, or you're weighing that against what it might be able to give you in terms of knowledge about your prospects and the people coming to your website, then maybe you're probably willing to give up a bit of performance in order for some additional data about those prospects. But if you're thinking about how you use the web, even, you know, in a B2B context, when you're researching a purchase, you are annoyed by a lack of speed and a lack of performance. If a site takes a while to load and you don't see anything for a bit, or it's kind of jumping around as it loads because you're looking at it on mobile and it wasn't necessarily coded properly for that, or, you know, you click on something and then everything has to start anew and all of that. Those are things that Google actually tracks. And if you've been in the marketing game for the last number of years, you would have heard of Core Web Vitals. And those are the three, and there are more, but the three core items that Google is tracking that influence rank from a speed perspective. And I know we're going to get into a little bit how maybe search performance isn't as important as it once was later in this episode, but it's still...
Well, I think it's still important. It can't throw the baby out with the bathwater here. But what are the three web vitals, just so people are clear on what we're talking about?
Yeah. So the three that we're talking about are largest contentful paint. And, you know, of course, web engineers have to use terms that really sound grandiose, but aren't necessarily. And what they mean by that is that, you know, is the largest area of the screen that you can see getting filled with content quickly? And there are guidelines around how quickly that needs to appear. So if you have if your main kind of banner image is a giant video that's 6 megabytes, and somebody is unfortunately looking at this on a 3G connection on their phone in New York City, if they have to wait 10 seconds for the area that is the biggest space that you're looking at to fill with content, you're going to be degraded on that metric. So the idea is to ensure that those large areas load quickly, to optimize your images, to, you know, use fewer bits of JavaScript that load before the page overall completes loading. Like, those things are all really important. The next one is cumulative layout shift. And this is one of those ones that, as a designer, it just makes me twitch. Exactly what it's describing. So basically, as a page loads, especially on a mobile device, if you're talking about a responsive website, you know, that has different layout parameters at different screen widths. So laptops versus tablets versus phones versus mid-size phones and all of these different things. You can have what are called breakpoints that determine that. If as those pieces of content are loading into the site, they cause other elements to shift down the page or move around and kind of confuse the viewer about what they're looking at or where it went, if a lot of that is going on, you're going to be graded poorly on the cumulative layout shift. So you want the site to render quickly and in place and be intuitive right out of the gate, no matter what device you're browsing on.
So it's kind of when that's not operating properly, it leads to that fault where you think you clicked on one button or one thing because it's loaded in, but something else, got it.
Yeah. And the other one is kind of a combination of the two, and it's interaction to next paint. So when you go to do something, like how quickly does the next thing load? You know, does the next screen load quickly? Are you able to interact with it quickly? You know, does the nav appear last?
As opposed to like leaving you wondering, did I click that or not? Did it get?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, ensuring that the next thing that you see, whether it's on the current page, so if you scroll and all the images are being lazy loaded, which means they get loaded early, you know, that can be good, but obviously you have to kind of play with those parameters somewhat. You know, if those images as you scroll down the page are available to you, you have a higher quality interaction to next paint. So, and I mean, you know, this is a difficult balance to play with because we have, you know, especially as marketers, typically that means you're in a place that has good bandwidth. You know, you're probably working with high quality equipment and newish phones and newish laptops, and you have a, you know, fiber to the office kind of thing, and you really don't think about slower speeds. But if you're selling into areas that don't necessarily have the same quality of network, it's still a concern. It's crazy to me because we were talking about this in like 2005, you know, and 20 years later, we're still talking about how there are regions of the world that are without high speed internet.
But even with high speed, it's still a concern. Like you're still getting ranked. It's still getting factored in to how your search performance will.
Well, and you know, a big part of that is the fact that there is so much bloat in every content management system unless you explicitly try to engineer it out. So, you know, if you're coming at this with enterprise grade systems like Adobe Content Manager, if you're coming at this with WordPress, you know, all of these platforms, if you're using pre-made templates that load a whole bunch of JavaScript up front, 5 megabytes, it's not uncommon for there to be 5 megabytes of JavaScript that loads before anything else is even rendered on the page.
Yeah.
You know, or you're kind of, because those commands need to be available to the rest of the page. So, you know, there's different ways to compact that and make it work. But, you know, if you have a 2-second expectation of how quickly that page should load, but you also want to show 3 3D models on the page, you know, you have to kind of balance it out, figure out what's most important.
It's interesting that you've said this a few times, this notion of you have to balance it out, you have to kind of figure it out. It's not just about applying the obvious single fix. It sounds almost a little bit more like CRO or something, where you're having to invest in it and kind of work through some experiments to optimize for what is best for you, for both your users as well as your rank.
For sure. And I think that, you know, the idea here is that you want to invest in speed where it makes sense, similar to how you would invest in pay-per-click advertising where it makes sense. You know, you're looking to buy keywords that have some intent to buy. Well, maybe you're optimizing the most important pages that have a role in the buyer's journey in your site.
Yeah. That are most important to get them to rank.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. You know, you're investing in the speed there, and then you can spread some of those, some of that extra speediness throughout the site.
Yeah, I would think so many speed investments kind of impact the site overall anyway.
For sure.
Yeah. Let's jump along to some of those evolutions in privacy that you spoke about.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to say, I think for the average non-marketer out there, or even maybe for a lot of marketers, it can be pretty annoying to hear all this conversation about how privacy is getting more strict. But you know, it seems like if you mention a product when you're speaking to your significant other, it starts being marketed to you on Instagram the next day. Like, it, you know, sometimes it can feel like it's kind of hard to square these two experiences. But what do we need to know about privacy in 2025, 2026, as we're building for the web?
Well, I mean, it's been talked about for years. Google themselves have waffled on what they're going to do from a cookie protection standpoint. We already know that Apple and other browser makers have taken more of a privacy first stance and automatically disallow tracking cookies and tracking pixels and other things like that. But Chrome still has the vast majority of, you know, if you're still using Chrome and Google to search for things, then that is the one place where you are still able to track certain things for now. Google has committed to basically eliminating tracking cookies and their ilk by the end of this year. We'll see if that actually comes to pass or if they waffle on it again. But it, you know, it does seem like the writing is in the sand somewhat for this. You know, you have different.
That's how you know you're on the coast, ladies and gentlemen. The writing's not on the wall anymore, but rather in the sand.
It's not on the wall. Yeah, it's moved to the sand. I was at the beach, you know, on the weekend, which is rare for me. But so. You need to start thinking about how you're going to track the users on your site using what's called first-party data. So these are things that you can stand up within Google Tag Manager that allow you to basically own your own data about the people that visit your web properties and, you know, kind of track things internally. You're not getting all the benefit of all the different AdWorks or ad networks telling you, you know, where this person has been and what their interests are and maybe what company they work for and all of those things. But, you know, if you can, you can work within the confines of your own owned platforms, as long as that data isn't being shared with anybody else or being brought in from anywhere else, and build your own database of customers and prospects and leads from the site. Hmm. So getting that information and beginning to compile that as soon as possible is going to become essential to being able to understand who's coming to your site, what are they doing when they get there, and you're not going to necessarily be as easily able to see that information or create targeting with the kinds of things that you maybe were before. So that's coming.
It feels to me that that's kind of man, especially if I'm hoping maybe you'll disagree with me, I don't know, but it feels like if you're a larger manufacturer, I mean, there's so many just big manufacturers out there that are like number one or two in their category. You know, they have almost a de facto level of market share without much marketing at all, simply because of being a household name in a space. And or a factory hold name in the space, one might say. But and it seems to me, because those are the people that maybe have, you know, 30-40% of the total addressable market coming to their website at some point over a year. It seems to me to be a real opportunity for them to harness
their lead.
Well, and you know, this makes me think that for the Davids versus the Goliaths of the world, it's going to be another, you know, the privacy rules are going to make it even that much harder to climb up the ladder. Does that make sense?
It does. But I mean, we still haven't gotten to the part where we talk about how people are getting found more in AI engines than they are in search engines. So I think it's important, yes. But maybe going forward with the way people are actually trying to find things, it becomes less important in terms from a targeting perspective and from a getting found perspective.
Well, if you're going to bring that up, let's just jump right into it. What are we doing? Because everybody knows, I mean, look, I'll say this, you know, here at Akula Partners, we onboarded our first client earlier in 2025 that from our sources report, we know found us via ChatGPT. That's a great thing. You know, so many of our clients have, you know, experienced that too in the last year or so. They're seeing their first bits of lead flow coming from generative engine search. So, I guess, how do we need to be thinking about web builds to accommodate that shift?
I think the web builds themselves maybe are probably fairly consistent with what they were before, at least in terms of, you know, your content management system and stuff like that. How you structure the content on individual pages needs to change. We need to tell these engines what things are. And I honestly wonder for how long we're going to need to do that before they are able to begin to deduce what types of content they're indexing, mm-hmm. and what it means and how it relates to other things contextually. But for now, we need to use what's called structured data on the content within our sites, especially as we're thinking about the products that we sell. So these are called schemas, and there are a number of them for all kinds of different industries. It's not dissimilar to NAICS codes and that sort of thing. Like, most industries have a way of marking up the products that they sell. You know, there are construction frameworks for building and construction. There are industrial frameworks for products within that. And then there are additional, more basic schema components around things like addresses and dates and other types of content, even podcasts, as an example. You have to tell the internet that your piece of content is a podcast, and this is the podcast it's part of, and this is the episode number, and all those different things. So that extra level of markup is going to become essential to getting found within these platforms, especially for things like SKU searches and product searches within niche categories and all of that. That's going to be really important.
And I think it's important to point out that this isn't new. I mean, you could have done all this 4 years ago. It's just, it wasn't as important. So, you know, there's a lift associated with how far down this path you go. And I mean, people, you know, rightly made certain, you know, balanced judgments about how far down the road they ought to be going. Is a juice worth the squeeze? And I guess what you're saying is that what's changed is it's so much more worth it now, because we have, for generative engine optimization, it's absolutely critical.
Absolutely. For these things to begin showing up in there, we need to tell them what kinds of content that they're looking at so that the engine understands it. But you also have to think about how people interact with GPTs. It's not the same. You know, when you go to Google, you search, you know, four-person tent or something like just that, and then maybe refine your search from there. In GPTs, it's more conversational. You know, maybe you're leaving out the please and thank yous in order to not burn up the extra energy that those terms apparently use. But you're asking questions in a lot of ways. So structuring the other content around your products and around what you sell, around this notion still, I mean, this is how we used to kind of write for SEO even 20 years ago. But now it's even more important is understanding the kinds of questions that people are asking, how they're asking them, and how they're refining those questions within the AI platforms. So, and what's interesting about this is that, you know, we think of domination in the search field belongs to Google. Domination in the AI field still belongs to ChatGPT, and that means Microsoft. So Bing is a more important platform in terms of being able to research how people are using tools like ChatGPT than maybe Google is and Gemini and the other platforms.
Yeah, it's a thing that I think people miss. And, you know, especially when you look at something like O3, where, you know, it's a reasoning engine, so you can actually watch it reason. What are the queries that it's searching? And then you can reverse engineer that. There are some more kind of technical ways to do that, or you can do it the hard way. But nevertheless, it is Bing that's being queried at that point.
Yeah.
I think people need to be mindful of that they are operating in a somewhat of a different ecosystem. And it does pull you out of, I think it was easy to fall into the trap of saying, you know what, generative engine optimization is just an awful lot like good quality SEO. What was good before is even better now. And that's true, but that's not all the truth, I guess, is it? That's not the total story.
For sure. And yeah, it's a really interesting time. And I don't want to, you know, that kind of like using Bing to reverse engineer ChatGPT queries, that may be a hack for now. It may not last. It's one of those things, but at least it can help you kind of understand how people are using those tools.
Yeah, I think that is important to note too, because there's so much, it's changing so fast that it's important to know if you're looking at a hack versus what does this tell me about how that helps me better understand how this functions at a core level. Yeah. What then? I know that you mentioned important to structure data, and I think it's somewhat connected to it. Is just there's been some enhancements. I think we see most of them out of Europe, but around just how they're thinking about product data governance, bringing a level of consistency to it that I think is even beyond web structured data.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, a lot of manufacturers, especially those of you that work with distribution networks, you know, are most likely aware of and use a product information management platform or PIM, you know, and that is still important. But how you think about this and how you use this information that you're feeding out to those that are representing your brand or your products to a broader market it's a bit different now. Like, you're able to actually structure the types of content that go into that, you know, and think of your data sheets as code that are actually, you know, pulled from a Git repository by the, you know, by the distributor, or, you know, changes that are made there get immediately permeated out to your entire network. You know, these are the kinds of things that you can begin to do to make, you know, to make it easier for distributors to work with you, to make it easier to customize content for your individual distributors, or provide them with the tools to customize that content on their own site. You know, there's some really interesting things going around about content being completely ignored by Google that was previously indexed, that, you know, nobody really knows kind of where it's going or why it's no longer being indexed, but it's been deprioritized because it's too similar and consistent with other people that sell the same product. So your page adds no value, you know. And those are going to be some interesting holes for organizations to work their way out of. And part of doing that from a, you know, a more structured perspective is just really controlling the data sheet content and really controlling the descriptions of the products, and ensuring that you're distributing it in a way that your resellers can action that and use it, and you know, have it amplify your business instead of take away from it.
Very cool. Well, I think we could probably go on for another half hour here, but I just think it's been a bit of a rapid deep dive in terms of how to, you know, some different considerations for building for the web in 2025, 2026.
And so the four things that we've talked about here, I think that every manufacturer can focus on in order to improve their web presence in 2025 and beyond, make sure that they're, you know, targeting AI search, structuring their content in a way that is going to make a difference, is, first of all, you got to invest in speed if you want to continue to be found on typical search engines, and probably generative search engines as well. I'm sure they prioritize speed as well. You know, think about those core web vitals. Use them as a lever that you can pull to improve revenue in certain areas, and invest in the quality and rapid delivery of your content. The second one is really getting a handle on your first-party data acquisition, because we've got a cookie deprecation situation coming up where you're not going to be able to track people the way you traditionally were. So you need to begin to own the leads and prospects and website visitors that you have, and begin to build a database of those folks so that you can better understand the people who are coming to your site currently. Really want to look into and understand how to structure the data for your industry. That's from a pure content perspective, whether we're talking about podcasts and location information and all of that, or, you know, if we're looking at the structure of your data sheets and all of that, and using a platform and a form for displaying that information like JSON-D. These are the kinds of things that you want to be using in order to ensure that your data can be found and used by your distributors. And part of that is that product data governance and syndication, and really thinking about your data in a way that it goes beyond just your site. So those are the four things that we talked about today, and I really hope that they can help.
I really hope our listeners got something out of this. I know I did. I think it's been a really, really interesting conversation. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, happy to share. Thanks a lot.